So Quentin Galuedak, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're very excited to have you here. You are a research engineer at Hugging Face, and we've had like this streak of folks from Hugging Face we've been lucky enough to talk to. So it's this ongoing thing to speak with people from Hugging Face. So we're very excited to continue sort of this conversation with you. And I think that one aspect of research that we always sort of failed to dive into is to try to actually listeners what it actually means in practice, right? It's sort of like this amorphous general term that we sort of know what it kind of is. But as a research engineer at Hugging Face, what is it that you do when you wake up, make your coffee, open up your computer, then what?
So I will speak about my job specifically, but remember that we are a team. So the overall goal is a broader than just what I do. I'm personally involved in developing the post-training library that we have. So it's called TRL. The goal for us is to provide the community a tool to easily train models, so post-train models to be more precise. So it's in the middle between research. So we try to be as up-to-date as possible with the recent literature, and also software development, so everything related to API, user-friendliness, stability, and everything that you can think as being common to every software that can be developed.
And I mean, this, we are entering the world of reinforcement learning here, which is something I've always wanted to cover here in the podcast and never had the opportunity. So I'm going to use you, Quentin, here to have this conversation with the folks here. We've seen many basically frameworks that are being used, not really frameworks, but techniques, algorithms that were being used since, I don't know, ChatGPT or GPT-3, GPT-4 came out with RLHF. Then we saw DPO from Stanford. We even interviewed Rafael Rafailov, the author of the paper of DPO here in the podcast. There was GRPO from the people at DeepSeek. And every new day we've been seeing newer techniques to do the reinforcement learning. So first of all, explain to our audience, please, what is reinforcement learning, how it works, and then how having a library such as the one that you are developing there at Hugging Face can help the usual developer or the usual researcher on their work.
Yeah, so maybe before understanding what is reinforcement learning, we need to say that it is one stage of the overall training pipeline of a model. Usually we start with a very expensive and very long stage, which is pre-training. It's pretty basic. It's just like you gather enormous quantity of data and you try to make the model predict this data autoregressively. And once you have that, once you've trained your model on the basically the whole available data out there, you end up with what we call a base model or a pre-trained model. And this model is basically useless. You cannot do barely anything with this model because it's not trained to follow instructions. It is not particularly good at doing anything, but it has seen enormous quantity of data. And we have a second stage, which is post-training. And the post-training can contain many types of training. Maybe the easiest one is SFT. So it is the first stage of post-training, is that you take a specific type of data. Let's say, for example, you're trying to solve math problem. So you would take math data and you would do SFT, so supervised fine-tuning, on this math data. And the goal is to make the model better at math specifically. And you can do it more broadly on instruction following. So basically, it's converting a base model to a chatbot, a model that you can interact with. And starting from there, you have a good model, but probably not good enough for what you need. If you want to tackle very, very tricky math problem, you will need to do better than just instruction following model. And at this point, this is where reinforcement learning is especially powerful, is that you can train a model to do better at the task that you can define with a reward signal. So let me say it in a different word. If you don't have label data, if you don't have ground truth data for a problem, you can, for example, create a reward function, for example, comparing the final answer against a predicted answer. And the model will try to make this reward signal increase. How it is doing that? It just generates data. So you ask a question, generates data, and then you try to assess whether this answer is correct or not. If it is correct, it got reinforced, hence the word reinforcement learning. And if it fails at doing the task, it would just do the opposite of reinforcement. So it just lowers the probability to predict this particular wrong answer.
That's basically what Richard Sutton came up with. He's one of the fathers, if not the father, of reinforcement learning, right? He was in some podcast recently, Dwarkash Patel, if I'm not mistaken. And do you really believe, like Sutton says, that we should not keep training the models the way they were training them right now, doing these phases of pre-training, post-training, SFTs and blah, and just trust basically more and more on reinforcement learning from the beginning even?
The thing with RL is that it's tricky to get a reward signal. What it means is that if you start from scratch, like from a randomly initialized model, and you apply RL on top of that, like without any training at all, your chance that the model will output like a correct answer for your task, it's basically zero. So what it means for the RL objective is that you don't have any reward signal to train on. If the model constantly outputs a wrong answer, you cannot train a model on top of this kind of data. So that's why applying RL from scratch is kind of tricky. That being said, there is an interesting fact that came out with DeepSeek R1. Is that they try that on the base model. So usually what we do is first SFT and then RL, and they try to apply RL directly on the base model. And what they found out is that it is possible. It actually gives some pretty cool and interesting results. And yeah, well, I think, well, overall, it's hard to say we should do it completely different or not. What I can witness right now is that doing SFT, then RL, and maybe DPO, it's giving like amazing results so far. And almost every, well, open training, we can tell that every model where the recipe is open source, you can see that they were trained using RL basically. So, I mean, it kind of works. Maybe we can do it better, but it works very good these days.
And your job, one of your jobs there at Hugging Face is maintaining this library, right? The TRL, which deals with that. So how did this come about? And how are you implementing these techniques into the library? Is that your job day to day?
Yeah, exactly. The goal is to implement the new methods. So this is one part of the job, implementing. Maybe it's the easiest one because you just read the paper and try to follow the instructions. Maybe the trickiest, and people probably don't realize that, is that you need to maintain over time like a reliable set of recipes, set of code, so that the user can rely on it. If they want to train DPO 2 years ago, they can do that. And if they want to use DPO to train their model right now, they can also do that. But it's not like magical. We just didn't implement DPO and kept DPO like that. We need to maintain it over time. And another tricky thing is that, so we mentioned RL, but the RL from early 2020, well, we can even go back. The RL from 2017 with PPO is very different from PPO used in RLHF in early 2021, sorry, and is very different from GRPO, which is used today to build frontiers models. And the thing is, when you develop these kind of libraries, you need to provide some kind of assumptions of what the methods are right now and what they will be in the future. And sometimes it's not easy to define some abstractions to be able to easily implement methods that don't exist yet.
You are at a company that is privileged enough to have some structure and great engineers tackling this problem. So one way to put it would be to sort of like say that you've been helping move these things along and evolve. So I'm always curious about what it is to be from the inside, not just watching the whole field evolve, but contribute to that as well, right? In the research, which is like in the forefront of research, right? To that will trickle down from there.
Yeah, well, it's very exciting because you, well, the team of the research team at Hugging Face is quite small. I would say we are something between 10 and 30 people, depending of the topic that you consider. But the thing is, it feels like you are involved within a broader community, and we are all, it seems to me that we are all asking the same questions, trying to tackle the very same limitations. It can be research or technological. I take one example. In RL, what you need to do is to generate data, for example. Well, you need to generate data. It's part of the training. But generation, it's not easy to do. It's if you want to do it fast, it's like it's a technical challenge to do it fast. So when you use libraries like VLLM to generate fast, it creates some kind of noise in the data, which is detrimental for the training. And it's kind of, yeah, some actual challenges. Like right now, it's how to make the RL training robust to this kind of noise. So we are working on it at Hugging Face, but I know that many other teams around the world are working on this very same topic. And when someone finds a reasonable solution, it gets shared, hopefully. But usually it's the case, and we can battle this method, try if it works on our data, and share our findings. So it's a very exciting job. It's like working for the whole community, for the whole frontier research.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I love Hugging Face so much. It's basically science / technology communication that is basically for everyone. I'm not a researcher yet, but I try my stuff and it helps a lot, everything that you produce. And when you are, when you find a new method, when people start publishing about a new method that maybe I could or I should add this to TRL, is it you who decides that it should go, that is going to be applied to TRL? Is it the team, or, and how do you go about it?
Yeah, this is a very tricky question because, as you can see, the number of papers per day is like gigantic. You cannot reasonably consider implementing everything from the research community. It's just impossible. And anyways, it's not something that we want. So we need to sort which one we will invest time on and which one we won't. Well, it kind of depends because some papers, they are like obviously valuable, and we can have it very easily in the TRL repository. So we can do it like within an hour, we can integrate it. And some of the paper, it's obvious that we don't want this into the repository because either it's hard to implement and/or it's not very valuable or it's very specific to a certain domain. And the tricky question is when we are right in the middle. Like it can be hard to implement, but maybe it can be useful for the community. So in this case, we discuss as a team and we evaluate if we want to add it. But maybe one very important thing is that we are not trying to assess whether this method is valuable or not in the training pipeline. So in different words, we are not trying to replicate the results. And based on whether it works or not, we will add it or not to the library. We feel that it's not really our job to replicate the results, but it's more like providing the implementation. And it's up to the community to assess whether this new methods is worth using or not.
But then you could, for example, decide to remove this method from the library or not really?
Yes. We try to provide some stability over time, but it can happen that at some point we decide just to remove the methods. This is something that we've done sometime. It's usually to help maintainability over time because some methods are very hard to maintain over time. And if it's basically used by 10 users and it requires a 1 hour every week to maintain, it's just not worth it. Another way to address this problem is to split the library between what is very important, like a core code base and an experimental code base. For example, in the core code base, we would have DPO, SFT that we mentioned, GRPO as well. And for the experimental code base, it would be more recent papers or some experimental things that we are not sure yet whether we will remove it at some point or promote it into the core code base.
And you were talking about the TRL library, right? Could you like take us back to how things started and became from this idea, this kernel of an idea by someone or sort of a team, and the process that got it to be released and how it's been since then?
Yeah, so this is very interesting because the project started 6 years ago with Leandro von Vera. And 6 years ago, we were in 2020. So just after, if I'm not mistaken, just after PPO was initially used to train language models. And at this time, I was not at Hugging Face. I was just starting my PhD on some, well, neighbors, but not this very specific project. So he started this project basically to replicate this PPO training pipeline with, well, as I mentioned, PPO at this time was very different from what we are doing right now to train models. And after that, SFT got added, and then DPO. And then at some point, I joined Hugging Face and started to work on this project. And the initial team just moved on to some other project. So, what I'm trying to say is that it's a 6 years old library, and the challenge is to maintain some kind of constant progress over time, even though the people involved in this library changed, even though the methods substantially changed over time, and even though the literature is evolving so fast. So I think this is something that we successfully managed to do, and recently the whole DeepSeek R1 wave with gRPO. So we need to some kind of reinvent the RL part of our library, and start to make it ready for the next waves, because I feel like there are going to be revolutionary new ways to train model, and we need to prepare the code base to be flexible enough to implement quickly these new methods. And right now it's a bit particular because we just released the first release candidate for V1. So V1, it's kind of like the contract with the user that the API is stable. It will remain stable. So we are basically moving from a research project, I would say, to a proper library, a proper software that people can use to make their own project, to make their own business. And we are kind of assuring that it will stay stable over time.
And you have only ever worked on TRL at Hugging Face?
I would say mostly yes. I joined 2 years ago. At Hugging Face, we have like a particular way of working. It's very flat, so we can work on many different subjects. And usually what we try to do is to have our own project and try to contribute to a neighbor's project. So, for example, what I call neighbor's project is, for example, PEFT, which implements every techniques like low rank adaptation for training models, transformers, which is like the core repository for every modeling open source transformers models, and accelerate, which is like the training part of the thing. And in my day-to-day job, I try not only to build TRL, but to build the whole ecosystem. So it involves contributing to every project that we depend on and that depends on us. So it's very interesting, like, to make your contribution shine across the whole ecosystem.
And you mentioned your PhD. What was it about exactly? What were you working on?
So my PhD was about reinforcement learning, but watch out, it is not the reinforcement learning of gRPO or PPO for RLHF. It's it was like kind of the old Psi RL. If you remember, Alpha Zero and the works from DeepMind were very popular at this time. Basically, it was RL for games. If I want to make it very easy to understand, so RL for games, not for language processing. My PhD was about to be able to apply RL on a problem. You need to have some efficient exploration. What it means is that if you want to solve an issue, you need to explore many different ways to be able to have a reasonable chance to find a way to successfully complete the task. And if you have successfully completed the task, you can get a reward signal, and you could get a learning signal, and you can increase the model capability to complete the task. And in RL, the critical part is that if you don't pay attention, your model is not incentivized to explore. So we need to kind of push the model to explore as much as possible. And if you remember the Atari games, so it's very old school games. I'm too young to have played these games. But it's funny because the easiest games were very easily solved by RL. If you think about Breakout, it was basically the first example when they introduced DQN. I think it was in early 2010s. And Well, basically, from when DQN was published and solved breakouts, and 10 years after that, there are some Atari games that are still not solved because of these exploration problems. You think about Montezuma's Revenge. Yeah, the other one I cannot remember. These are, it can be like very hard for an agent to explore as much as needed to get the first, let's say the first, score increase, to get the first reward signal. So yeah, this was my PhD was about, is about exploration in RL.
That's very interesting, actually. But in your opinion, is this a problem that basically every reinforcement learning technique has inherently, or is something that the newer techniques have solved?
Well, I think recent technique they do not explore well at all. But what is it working anyways? It's because for language model RL, it's not very important to be very efficient at exploration. For example, if you take GRPO, so the principle in GRPO is, for example, you ask a question and the model will generate 16 different responses. You can set the level of randomness by the temperature, for example, the sampling temperature, and it will provide 16 different possible answers. And usually among these 16 possible answers, you would get some kind of positive reward at some point. So it's usually pretty easy to get a reward signal in this case, if you have a data set which is not too hard for the model being trained. The difference is we are training language models here. So the task does not involve it does involve exploration, but not that much compared to what Atari games would require to be solved. Because if you think about it, let's say that you are a player and you don't know the rules of a certain games, and you need to explore like 5 different rooms within these games to get the first reward. As a human, you know that you need to go to the next room and see what is happening. But for a model, it's very hard to explain, like, you know this room. Maybe you should, even though there is no reward here, you need to maybe look what is in the next room. And unless you take particular care of this exploration problem, it would just explore randomly. And randomly discover the 5th room, it's very unlikely.
How do you set the model to do this exploration then?
There are many ways to do that. Maybe a very funny one, a very efficient one, is to ignore the reward from the environment. So usually if you need exploration within an environment, it usually means that the reward signal from the environment, it's not very helpful for the task. So let's say it's basically 0. So you would ignore for a while the reward from the environment, and you would create your own reward signal by some measure of curiosity. This is what we call curiosity exploration. You can, for example, measure how surprising is the outcome of a given action. And if it is surprising, this is something that you want to reward. So you make basically a new reward signal. We call it intrinsic reward signal. And this basically incentivizes the agent to find things that it couldn't have predicted, basically, if it makes sense. And if you do that again and again, if I take again this room example, after some time, it would have basically nothing very surprising in this first room. So it will try to reach areas that are hard to predict for itself. And it can be exploring the second room and then again and again. And at some point, based on this intrinsic curiosity, it will reach the 5th room where you have the environment signal. This is one way, but there are many other ways. The intrinsic curiosity is funny because initially it was designed from cognitive science. Intrinsic motivation is not an AI concept originally. As far as I know, it's a behavioral concept from childhood where we try to understand how childs understand and just not like stay still and wait for food.
It's really interesting because we had an episode recently with a colleague here in Brazil, Adrian Valentim, and we were speaking exactly about this and how most things or many concepts from AI come from neuroscience, things like, I don't know, even the the perceptron, the neuron, all of these, like, the names even come from biology, you know, and from neuroscience. And some of the people at the beginning of AI, they were actually psychotherapists or people that studied neuroscience. And they still do, like Demis Hassabis. And since I mentioned Hassabis, and we're speaking about reinforcement learning, it would be, I don't know, silly of me not to bring up to the conversation one of the most famous cases of reinforcement learning being applied to something, first to something fun and then to something useful. First, we can say about AlphaGo, or before, like when they were doing for chess, and then AlphaGo, AlphaZero, and later AlphaFold, that is actually pretty useful for humanity. And speaking about how they did this, and especially like AlphaGo was 10 years ago, was 2000 or more than 10 years ago, 2015, I believe, or 16, something like this. So how did they implement these techniques into what was back then AlphaGo that evolved to AlphaZero that only relied on reinforcement learning?
I think it's because, first of all, they have a very deep understanding of the problem itself. They were not trying to tackle RL in general, but they were trying to tackle RL for these specific tasks. And the thing is, when you work like this, you can basically drop many things that can be tricky. For example, in the game of Go, it's a two-player game, and the state is discrete. There is no like continuous state or a continuous action. So it's basically a specific case of RL. And another thing in Go, which is the same for chess, is that you need to wait very, very, very long to get the first reward signal. So basically you need to wait like a full game. I don't know how many turns there is in Go, but I think it's probably more than, maybe 100. I don't want to say something wrong, but it's like many turns before getting the first reward signal. So they applied something very tailored to this kind of problem, which is Monte Carlo tree search and its variants. So this is for the, I would say the scientific questions. And there were also the technical challenge. I'm not very familiar with what they did about the computers and everything, but I know that at this time it was very early, like there were no very stable PyTorch or CUDA implementation for this kind of network. So they basically had to implement a good amount of this stack themselves at a low level. And it's the combination between like very talented scientific tackling a very specific subject and solving these kind of very technical questions about how to do inference fast and fast enough not to require a billion years to solve the problem, but just a couple of months.
There's another question I'm always curious when we talk with researchers, which is to ask, how has the actual use of AI been making its way in your day-to-day work, in your research work? How have you been actually using this to help evolve AI, if that makes sense?
And especially maybe if I can add, after December last year, December 2025, which is when they say that there was like a whole revolution in the field of LLMs for coding specifically.
Yeah, so I can tell definitely that the last few months were very different from the year before. So yeah, in my opinion, they were like very a corner turn in probably 3 months ago in the way we work. Before, so last year I was using extensively AI to write better code, to write better English, to basically it was mostly for code and language modeling, but code in a way, like a very basic way. Like, for example, you implement some torch function and you ask the model, is there a better way to do that? Or is there some kind of built-in function that I'm not aware of? I was using extensively for that. And for the last 3 months, we have some autonomous agents, which are very powerful. So you can basically give them high level instructions about what you want to do. I don't know, for example, I want to refactor this trainer to move the truncation logic from this method to this other method. Usually it would take, for example, for me, it would take, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes to do it because I need to check whether it's doing what I want, what I need to do. But for an agent, so the task is pretty basic, but you need to be careful not to mess up. And the agent is very useful because it would do it in like 2 minutes. And do it pretty good, actually. And so a lot of time saved for us. And another aspect where it is very useful is for code review. So if you spend some time on GitHub and on some popular open source repository, you would see many pull requests being commented by agents that basically do the job of a reviewer. So try to understand what the pull request is about. Try to find tricky edge cases where you didn't realize, but it breaks other things. And before December last year, it was very basic, very, very bad at doing this kind of task. But from now, I think I can tell that usually it's doing a better job than us on reviewing, like finding some edge cases, finding some kind of inconsistency in the code. So it helps a lot. The thing is, it comes with some problems that we've been witnessing recently in the communities, that we are starting to have AI generated pull requests on our repository, which is, well, it can be good, it can be valuable, but the thing is, we have limited resources to review the pull requests. And usually this kind of AI generated agents, they are not tackling an issue that a real user would face. It would just solve something that can be solved in the repo, if that makes sense. So it kind of distracts the reviewer attention from the code base part, which is actually used by the user. So it's kind of, like an open question right now is how to, what to do with this kind of contributions, which are what we call AI slop. I hope that we will find a way to make this valuable for us, and we will see. But it is a very recent problem that we are starting to have at Hugging Face.
Not only on Hugging Face, we are speaking with, I don't remember with whom, but even in academia, that now you have thousands and thousands of papers being published and archived every single day, produced by AI. And many times the result is not something either useful or relevant or even wrong. Many times it's like just plain wrong with wrong references. This kind of thing still happens nowadays. And I mean, it's a problem not only for you guys, but for the whole academia, for the whole society, I would say, as a whole. And speaking about this, going back to post-training and how you are doing that, when you look at it, what do you think it's the most important part or the most underrated part when you talk about RL, but not only? Is it like having a better reward design, better data curation, or just a better system overall, like more power compute as well?
I think personally that so all these questions are valid, and we need to do a better job for the reward for the infra and stuff. But the thing is, I feel like RL is very tailored for math and code. And this is for a good reason, is that most people working on it are basically good at math and code because this is their background. So they see math and code problems and they are trying to fix it with AI. But for example, is AI useful for healthcare, for example, or for drug discovery? Yeah, probably, but not in the extent of what we are using right now in code. And I feel like it's not a limitation of RL. It's a limitation of the problems that we want to tackle right now with AI. And what I would like to see is some kind of expansion of the area of the subject that we want to tackle with RL. There are probably some very specific type of reward that we want to implement for, health, medicine, or subject like this, or law, for example. The thing is, it's getting very little attention, mostly because people working on it are not very sensitive to these kind of subjects.
And when you are training the models nowadays, the your own models, because you have small LM and you are training other models. We spoke with Leandro von Vera very recently, actually, about this. But in your perspective, when you want to apply everything that you are learning and creating there inside within Hugging Face to a real project, to a real model such as those, do you have everything that you need nowadays? Would you need more compute power, do you think? Or can you just like run jobs and let them go for days or weeks?
Hugging Face, we are the main subject of Hugging Face is not training models. Well, consequently, we don't spend like a huge amount of money on our cluster. I think we are spending a substantial amount of money, but it's not comparable to Chinese labs or other US labs. So we have some constraint on this compute resource, and it's probably one of the reasons that we want to make small language model more to boost the adoption of small language model, because we are not the only one being limited by the resource. Basically, everyone is limited by resources. So most people would be able to run a 4B model, but a 1 trillion model, it's just for a few labs around there. So we have limited resources. I think we have enough resources right now to build some amazing stuff. What is probably not the case in other labs, and what I like in Hugging Face is that we are very flexible on resources and more broadly on everything, but specifically on the resources. We have access to the cluster. If I need, 100 GPUs for 1 week, I don't have to feel a complex process to explain why I need this. I can just launch my experiments and make sure that it's not too much annoying for the others. And, I think it's very important to foster proactive research to give individuals the capacity to launch expensive jobs, expensive runs easily. And that's what I like at Hugging Face.
Well, I mean, sometimes technical constraints make you be creative and come up with something that is unexpected, right? Many of the advancements we've seen in the latest years sort of stem from that, which is pretty interesting. So who knows? And speaking a little bit about that, is there, without giving anything that you don't want to give away, but are there other fields or other techniques or other technologies you're interested in researching right now that you go like, well, this could be something big or interesting in the future that you've got your eyes on, even if you're not actually researching or working on it at all right now?
Something that, well, it's not very, probably very surprising for you, but I feel like we are just starting our journey with agents. It's a new paradigm to create, and there are probably many research questions that will arise from there. And I feel like this is pretty much the beginning of this area. And I think that I'm not wrong on this. We can have another chat 6 months from there and see how much research was done on agents. But I'm very curious to see if some hard math questions will be solved by a model someday. I honestly don't know. I feel for me it's a 50-50 because I don't know. So I'm curious to see if this kind of unreachable level of complexity can be reached by a model. I don't know, to be honest.
And you started working at Hugging Face, which is basically a mix of research, product, community, open source, which is the reason why we love it. And how do you handle this part of dealing with the community, publishing stuff? And also, have you seen anything that the community published based on something that you created that really shocked you or surprised you? You were not expecting that they would take it to this specific site?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. One on Hugging Face first is that at first I was hired to be a researcher at Hugging Face. And in the post-training team, we used TRL because it was our internal but open source tool. And I enjoyed doing this open source stuff, which is not specifically a research work, but it's still something that we're trying to push at Hugging Face. So naturally, my mission evolved to that. So it's kind of the strength of Hugging Face to have some flexible organization. If someone likes something, it can work on something, and no process or no headaches involved. We can just do stuff. And that's amazing because I feel like there is a gap between what I perceive from the community and what the community actually builds on top of what we do. And sometimes we just realize that some other projects were heavily based on what we do, or some amazing models or some amazing data sets, some amazing business. For example, so TRL is to train language model and visual language model. And I realized that it can actually be used to train a text-to-speech model. So basically, my work was used to create some kind of voice generator, and I didn't expect that. Another thing is probably some of your listener will know, but Unsloth, ANSOS is a very successful project in post-training, and not only in post-training, but specifically in post-training. And they are heavily based on TRL. And that's amazing because they are doing a fantastic job at democratizing RL, democratizing post-training. And I think that we can say that it is thanks our open source contributions that they were able to build this amazing Unsloth stack on top of Hugging Face. So yeah, but yeah, I think there is definitely a gap between what we perceive and what people actually do. So if some of the users actually listen to this podcast, feel free to share. And we are always amazed to see what can be built on top of not only TRL, but every Hugging Face product.
And this is a question about a sort of like this parallel universe that has been evolving over the last few years, but particularly more recently, which is about world models. We've seen, and Fabrice always talks about how this is one of the next hot things that are getting increasingly important, right? Have you been paying any attention to it at all? Is it something that you see the potential? Is it something that's maybe a little bit too far off to actually invest time in it right now? How have you been, if at all, looking at world models?
Yeah, well, actually, world models are like, it's not new. It's an old concept. I remember having this in my radar when I was involved in my PhD. I feel, I'm probably wrong about this, but I feel like this world model is a cool idea, but it still misses some kind of huge success right now. And it's kind of like in the area where you have these ideas that are amazing, but not very useful yet. World models have been used to train RL models way before RLHF, and they are still used to do that. But I feel like they still maybe are outdated on this, but I feel like they are still way more expensive than PPO for RL. They don't have any huge success in LLM post-training. So yeah, I'm curious to see. Honestly, I won't bet on world models because the world is very expensive to model. But yeah, maybe, I don't know. I would be happy to be wrong on this because I feel like it's an amazing idea.
And if you had all the compute power in the world, I'm talking a lot about compute power, I don't know why, but it's just something that is really interesting because it can hinder as well. Like Marcus said, it can help you get more creative if you don't have that much, but it can hinder you if you have like a great idea and you really want to do it and it's going to take 100 years because you don't have all 200,000 GPUs like XAI or Meta or whoever. So if you had all of this compute power just to yourself, not to your company, just to yourself, what would you be working on right now?
Yeah, it will probably not surprise you too much, but I will probably launch some RL training because the thing is, what is amazing with RL is that you know how you define the task, but you don't know what will come out from how you define the task. And for a little bit of history, at some point, OpenAI released this very cool demo of hide and seek back in the days. I don't know if you remember, guys, but I think this is what made me choose to do a PhD in RL. Basically, it was a simulation where two little characters were playing hide and seek, so it's a simulation, and you can see that after 1,000 steps, they were discovering how to interact with objects to hide and behind objects, and at some point they started to create like strategies where one player had one task and another player has another task to be even more efficient hide and seek. And at some point, after, I don't know, 10,000 steps, I can't remember, but they found a way to hack the simulator, basically to place an object in a way that would just make them go out of the simulation. So it would be basically impossible to find them. And so obviously it was not expected by the initial builders of this. And I feel like if you do the same with a language model, you just specify a broad task and you make it train for long enough, you could end up with some amazing results, some emergent behavior that you wouldn't have expected. Of course, it will be like a huge amount of wasted compute because if you are not careful, you can just make a learning progress happen in 1,000 steps, whether you could just have in one step if you just have dedicated a bit more time to better specify your reward. But yeah, in this parallel world where I have infinite compute, I would probably do that.
Amazing. And now you mentioned this, made me remember one that I consider, if not the best, one of like at least top five best videos that exist on YouTube. I already mentioned it here before, but it's a guide that he created a video, I think it's like 30 or 40 minutes long. And it's him teaching Pokemon Red, the Game Boy game, how to play with reinforcement learning. And it's amazing. I don't want to think how long it took him just to edit this video, because it's beautifully the way he explains it. Just the whole thing, like doing it must have been a lot of work, but editing it and creating all the storytelling behind it is just amazing. The link is going to be here in the description for all you guys at home to watch it. But it gave me the same idea of researching and going after reinforcement learning. And now I'm doing a master's degree, and I may go after reinforcement learning because of this Pokemon video.
Actually, that's very fun that you mentioned it, because if I'm not mistaken, this project was based on Stable Baselines as an RL library. I hope that I'm not wrong, but Stable Baselines was a project that I was involved in before Hugging Face.
Oh, wow.
I was a co-maintainer of this library. And this is exactly the kind of fun project that I discovered afterward that you mentioned earlier. Like when I discovered this guy solving Pokemon with basically the code I wrote, it just amazed me so much. And probably it's one of the reasons I love open source, is that you can just build stuff and other people will just use it for other amazing stuff. And yeah.
That's amazing, man.
Quentin, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks want to continue maybe this conversation with you, stay up to date with what you're doing, where should they go?
They could reach me on Twitter or LinkedIn. You can find me very easily. Just type my name and I will be there.
Muito obrigado. A gente vai deixar os links na descrição. Parabéns pelo seu trabalho, para sua equipe inteira. E para você que chegou até o finalzinho desse episódio, deixa eu lembrar você que você tem últimos dias, basicamente, para garantir o seu lugar para ir comigo, com o Fabrício Carraro, com o Paulo Silveira e também com o Marcelo Almeida, lá para o Vale do Silício, de 31 de agosto, dia 4 de setembro, visitar uma série de empresas, e não só empresas também, visitar as universidades que estão nessa fronteira do conhecimento, do desenvolvimento, de tudo que a gente conversa aqui, basicamente duas vezes por semana, fora o que a gente conversa em off, todo mundo, né? Então passa aqui na descrição. Fabrício, você também já está com a passagem comprada, que eu sei, mas hotel reservado?
Tô com a passagem comprada, tô com hotel reservado e já tô com o visto. Então agora é só embarcar, Marx.
Maravilha, eu também já azeitei tudinho. Agora é só ir também, te espera poder ir com você que está escutando. Não perde essa chance que a gente vai voltar. É claro que a gente vai voltar e passar o tempo inteiro falando de como foi legal, né? Então não perde, vai ser muito interessante. E claro, né, a gente fala sobre como vai ser divertido, mas aprender muito. Os contatos, as palestras que a gente vai assistir direto nas empresas, esse vai ser o benefício que vai dar para tirar dessa viagem, vai te deixar mais preparada, mais preparado para entender o que está rolando, ver o que vem por aí, né? Não vão passar para a gente qual que vai ser o próximo GPT, mas entender a direção que está apontando, estando lá imerso, imersa no Vale do Silício, é exatamente o que pode fazer a diferença daqui para frente. Até a próxima viagem, quem sabe, né? Então passa aqui na descrição do episódio, pega o link, conversa com o pessoal da Starts. Lembrando que se você comentar que escuta o IA Sob Controle, pode ter, talvez, quem sabe, um descontinho esperando por você, mas não perde tempo, porque ó, já estamos aqui na metade de abril, tem que ver o visto, tem que ver passagem, tem que ver hotel, né? Passaporte, vai saber como é que tá seu passaporte, né? Então agiliza para não ficar tarde demais para resolver isso, e eu e o Fabrício voltaremos na sexta-feira com o nosso resumão das notícias do mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.